Geekscape.com.
The Bizarre Story of Kristallnacht by Ingrid Wickart, Part 2. It was Herschel Feibel Grinspan who initiated the entire Kristallnacht affair by shooting the secretary of the German embassy in Paris, Ernst von Rath. History writers tell us that the 17-year-old Grinspan was merely a poor Jewish boy who had been driven to despair by the injustice done to his family, and who in his deep depression shot the young German diplomat. The fact is, however, that Grinspan had not shown any previous interest in his family's fate. He had wanted to be free of them, and had gone to Paris to live on his own. When the French police asked Grinspan why he had shot von Rath, he gave several contradictory explanations. Version 1. He did not mean to kill von Rath. He had wanted to kill the German ambassador, but because he did not know the ambassador personally, he shot von Rath instead, by mistake. Version 2. He had only wanted to kill himself, but wanted to do so directly beneath the portrait of Adolf Hitler. In this way, he hoped to become a symbol for the Jewish people who were being murdered daily in Germany. Version 3. He had not intended to kill anyone. Although he had a pistol in his hand, he did not know how to handle it properly, and it simply went off accidentally. Version 4. He could not remember what had happened while he stood in von Rath's office. All he remembered was that he was there, but he did not remember why. Version 5. He could not understand the question at all. He must have had a complete blackout, because he no longer remembered anything. And finally, version 6, which he gave several years later to German officials. Whatever the French police had written down about his reason was nonsense. The true story is that he used to procure young boys for the German embassy secretary because von Rath had been a homosexual, and he shot von Rath because he had not been paid for his services. This is the only explanation which he later retracted during interrogation. However, none of these explanations are correct. The true story is far less heroic. Grinspan had left his family in Hanover, Germany, in 1936 after finishing elementary school, but without graduating. His father had been a piecework tailor who had moved from Poland to Germany after the First World War. Herschel had a reputation for disliking work, and he hung out at the homes of his uncles in Brussels and Paris. In February 1938, his Polish passport expired, and the French government refused to renew his residence permit. As a direct result, his Paris uncle insisted that Herschel leave his home because he was afraid of getting into trouble with the law. And now, the story begins to get extremely interesting. Although Grinspan had no job or money, because his uncle refused to support him, he was nevertheless able to move into a hotel. His hotel just happened to be around the corner from the offices of an important and influential Jewish organization, the International League Against Anti-Semitism, or LICA. The questions which now arise are, who supported him after February 1938, and who paid for his hotel room? Although he had no apparent means of support, or even valid identity papers, between February and November 1938, Grinspan was nevertheless able to purchase a handgun for 250 francs on the morning of the 7th of November 1938, and then, about an hour later, go to the German embassy and shoot von Rath. LICRA, previously named the LICA, is a Jewish supremacist hate group, which operates in France on a firmly francophobic platform. It is the French equivalent of the ADL of B'nai B'rith and has a very similar history. The group was founded in 1927 to celebrate the murder of Ukrainian liberation activist Simon Petliura by Jewish terrorist Shalom Schwarzbard. It was founded by Bernard Lacache, who was a member of the French Communist Party and the Grand Orient de France. Greenspan was arrested at the scene and was taken to a police station. Although he was a totally obscure Polish Jew with no money and no apparent supporters, nevertheless, one of France's most famous lawyers, Mauro Giaffre, appeared at the police station a few hours after the shooting and told the police that he was Greenspan's attorney. Nothing could possibly have appeared about the shooting in any newspaper before his arrival. How then could Mauro Giaffre have possibly known about the shooting? Why was he so eager to defend this young foreigner? And finally, who were going to pay his attorney fees? As it turned out, Giaffre took good care of Greenspan during the following years. Before the Greenspan case could come before a French court, the war broke out. After the Germans occupied France, he was turned over to them by the French authorities. He was taken to Germany, where he was interrogated many times, but no trial ever took place. Mauro Giaffre, who had moved to Switzerland in the meantime, still managed to take good care of Greenspan. Many German officials were actively interested in the case. They wanted Greenspan brought to trial, but this never happened. Rumours circulated. A trial date was scheduled, but then postponed, again and again and again. Whenever any official asked why Greenspan had not been brought to trial, he was given a different answer every time. The veil of mystery surrounding this case was lifted only slightly many years after the war, when a note was discovered among the many hundreds of pages in the Greenspan file. This single short note stated simply that the trial against Greenspan would not take place for other than official reasons. It gave no further explanation. Although the National Socialist regime supposedly committed the greatest imaginable crimes against the Jews, the murderer Greenspan survived the war and returned to Paris. Why to Paris, where he could still have been arrested and tried for murder? But instead, he received a new name and new identity papers there. From whom? Who was in Paris to help him, and once again take such good care of him? Incidentally, the Greenspan family also survived the war. The young man's father, mother, brother and sister were deported to Poland as a result of the Polish passport affair, and shortly thereafter was somehow able to emigrate to Palestine. Amazingly enough, this took place at a time when immigration to Palestine was limited to persons who possessed at least 1,000 English pounds in cash. Greenspan's father, a poor piecework tailor, certainly never had a fortune of 4,000 English pounds. Many years after the war, the father testified at the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem that he and his family had to give up all of their money, except for 10 marks per family member, when they arrived at the German-Polish border in October 1938. How did they ever raise the 4,000 English pounds only a short time later for their migration to Palestine? Who organized their move? Perhaps the answer to all of these questions is Mauro Giaffre. He was not a sorcerer, but someone even more powerful. He was the legal counsel of the LICA. The LICA was founded in Paris in 1933 by the Jew Bernard Lacache and operated as a militant propaganda organization against real or imagined anti-Semitism. Its main office is still in Paris, at the same address it was at in 1938. Now known as the LICRA, it unsuccessfully sued Robert Faurisson a few years ago. Mauro Giaffre was well worth the fees the LICA paid him as its legal counsel. He apparently enjoyed spectacular scenes. He had already achieved international renown at a mass meeting in Paris following the Berlin Reichstag fire of February 1933. Without knowing at all what had happened, he nevertheless delivered a spiteful speech against National Socialist Germany, in which he accused Hermann Göring of setting the fire. In February 1936, Geoffrey hurried to Davos, Switzerland, where the Jew, David Frankfurter, had shot and killed Wilhelm Gustloff, the head of the Swiss branch of the German National Socialist Party. During the subsequent trial, it was clearly established that Frankfurter had been a hired murderer with backing from an unidentified but influential organization. All clues pointed to the LICA, but with Moreau Geoffrey as his defence counsel, Frankfurter remained silent about who, if anyone, had hired him. Amazingly enough, Frankfurter's answers to questions about the shooting showed the same pattern as Greenspan's answers almost 3 years later, after Geoffrey arrived to help after the shooting of Ernst von Rath. Like a medal, the Crystal Knight has two sides. One side lies in the shining glare of historical research, while the other remains in the shadows. Until now, no one, at least as far as I know, has tried to examine the hidden side. In the wake of the Crystal Knight, almost everyone wanted to know who the culprits were. Dr. Goebbels had to give an official explanation, which was, in effect, that the German people had been so enraged by the murder of Ernst von Rath that they wanted to punish the Jews and therefore started the pogrom. But Goebbels did not really believe this story himself. To several persons, he expressed his suspicion that a secret organization must have instigated the entire affair. He simply could not believe that anything so well organized could have been a spontaneous popular outburst. One must understand the broad popularity of the National Socialist regime at that time to realize how incredibly difficult it was to imagine that any secret, well organized opposition movement could have instigated such a pogrom. We now know about some of these so-called resistance organizations, but at that time, such well-organized opposition groups seemed preposterous. So overwhelming was the popularity and self-confidence of Hitler and the National Socialist government. Although the National Socialists were probably more aware of the danger of Jewish power and influence than anyone else, they nevertheless totally underestimated it. In a real sense, they were far too naive. One consequence of this enormous popularity and self-confidence was that the party leaders themselves simply could not imagine that it was not one of their own colleagues behind the whole affair. Among the party leaders, fingers were being pointed in all directions. Apparently, to avoid internal wrangling and the harm that this would do to their public image, an investigation to determine the instigators never took place. Hitler believed that Dr. Goebbels, his closest confidant and the one man he could never abandon, had been the instigator. The only persons actually punished were individual SA men who had participated directly in the pogrom and been accused in German courts of murder, assault, looting, or other criminal acts by Jewish or German witnesses to these crimes. But before any of these cases ever actually came to trial, Hitler issued a special decree ordering the postponement of all such cases until after the accused individuals were first prosecuted by the Supreme Party Court, an internal court concerned with discipline within the National Socialist Party organization. The most severe punishment which the court could impose was expulsion from the party. In this way, the party hoped to remove any guilty members from its own ranks before they appeared as defendants in the criminal courts. In February 1939, the chief judge of the Supreme Party Court, Walter Buch, reported his findings to Hermann Göring From an examination of the Buch report, as well as many documents from some of the thousands of trials of so-called Nazi criminals held after the war, and corroborating testimony by thousands of defendants and witnesses, I have been able to gain a detailed and accurate understanding of what actually happened during those fateful days and nights of November 1938. Already, on the 8th of November, 1938, one day before the Kristallnacht, strange persons, who had never been seen there before, suddenly appeared in several small towns in Hessen, near the French-German border. They went to mayors, district party leaders, and other important officials in these towns, and asked them what actions were being planned against the Jews. The officials were rather startled by these questions and replied that they did not know of any such plans. The strangers acted as if they were shocked to hear this. They shouted and complained that something had to be done against the Jews, and then, without further explanation, they disappeared. Most of those who were approached by these strangers reported the incidents to the police or discussed them with friends. They usually regarded the strangers as crazy anti-Semites and promptly forgot about the incidents until the next evening. Some of these apparently crazy individuals really outdid themselves. In one case, two men, dressed as members of the SS, went to an SA colonel and ordered him to destroy the nearby synagogue. To understand the absurdity of this, one must know that the SS and the SA were completely separate organizations. A real SS member would never have tried to give orders to an SA unit. This case shows that the strangers were foreigners who did not even understand the distinctions of German authority. The SA rejected the demands of the self-styled SS men and reported the incident to their superiors. When the provocateurs realized that their efforts were not working with local officials, they changed their tactics. Instead, they tried to incite directly the people in the streets. In another town, for example, two men appeared at the marketplace and began making speeches to the people there, trying to incite them against the Jews. Eventually, some people did indeed storm the synagogue, but by then the two provocateurs had, of course, disappeared. Similar incidents occurred in several towns. Unidentified strangers suddenly appeared, gave speeches, started throwing stones at windows, stormed Jewish buildings, schools, hospitals, and synagogues, and then disappeared. These unusual incidents had already started on the 8th of November, that is, before Ernst von Rath was dead. His death was only reported late on the evening of the 9th. The fact that this strange pattern of incidents had already begun one day earlier proves that the death of von Rath was not the reason for the Kristallnacht outburst. Von Rath was still alive when the pogrom began. And this was only the beginning. Well-organized and widespread incidents began on the evening of the 9th of November. Groups of generally five or six young men, armed with bars and clubs, went down the streets, smashing store windows. They were not Jew-hating SA men, enraged over the murder of a German diplomat. They operated too methodically to have been motivated by anger. They carried out their work without any apparent emotion. Nonetheless, it was their destruction that encouraged certain other individuals from the lowest social classes to become a mob and continue the destruction. There is another mysterious aspect to all this. Several district and local party leaders were awakened from their sleep in the middle of the night by telephone calls. Someone claiming to be from the regional party headquarters or the regional party propaganda bureau would ask what was happening in the official's town or city. If the party official answered, "Nothing, everything is quiet," the telephone caller would then say in German slang that he had received an order to the effect that the Jews were going to get it, tonight, and that the respective official should carry out the order. In most cases, the party leader, disturbed from his sleep, did not even understand what had happened. Some simply dismissed the call as a joke and went back to bed. Others called back the office from where the telephone voice had pretended to be calling. If they managed to reach someone in charge, they were often told that nobody knew anything about such a call, but if they reached only a lower official, they were often told, "Well, if you got that order, you'd better go ahead and do what you were told." These telephone calls caused considerable confusion. All this came out months later, during the trials conducted by the Supreme Party Court. The chief judge concluded that in every case a misunderstanding had arisen in one link or other of the chain of command. But when they were confronted with apparently genuine orders to organise demonstrations against the Jews that night, most of the party leaders had simply not known what to do. The pattern of seemingly sporadic anti-Jewish incidents in small towns followed only later by a carefully planned outburst in many large cities throughout Germany, clearly suggests the work of a centrally organised group of well-trained agents. Even shortly after the Kristallnacht, many leading party officials suspected that the entire affair had been centrally coordinated. Significantly, even Hermann Gramel, the only West German historian who has written in detail about the Kristallnacht, carefully distinguished between provocateurs and people who were simply carried away by their emotions and spontaneously took part in the riot and destruction. Without providing the slightest shred of real evidence, Gramel claims that the provocative agents were directed by Dr. Goebbels. While all this was happening across the Reich, a special annual commemoration was being held in Munich. 15 years earlier, on the 9th of November 1923, a movement led by Adolf Hitler, Erich von Ludendorff, a leading First World War general, and two major figures in the Bavarian government tried to depose the legal government and take responsibility themselves as a new national government. The uprising, or Putsch, was put down, and 16 rebels were shot down next to the Feldernhall, a famous old monument building in central Munich. Accordingly, the 9th of November had been commemorated every year since 1933 as the Memorial Day for the martyred heroes of the National Socialist Movement. Adolf Hitler and the party veterans, as well as all of the regional party leaders, met every year in Munich for the occasion. Hitler would usually deliver a speech to a select audience of party veterans at the famous Bürgerbraukeller restaurant on the evening of the 8th. On the morning of the 9th, Hitler and his veteran comrades would reenact the 1923 march to the Feldernhall. On the evening of the 9th, the Führer always held an informal dinner at the old town hall with old comrades as well as all the Gauleiters. At midnight, young men who were about to enter the SS and the SA were sworn in at the Feldernhall. All of the Gauleiters and other guests participated in this very solemn ceremony. After it was over, they left Munich and returned to their homes throughout the Reich. It is clear that the 9th of November date was chosen very cleverly. The annual commemoration ceremony of that day ensured that almost all of the Gauleiters would be away from their home offices when the anti-Jewish demonstrations began. In other words, the actual decision-making responsibilities that were normally carried out by the Gauleiters were temporarily in the hands of lower-ranking individuals with less experience. Between the 8th and the 10th of November, subordinate officials stood in for the Gauleiters who were either in Munich or en route to or from the annual commemoration there. This temporary transfer of decision-making authority is very important because it contributed to much of the subsequent confusion and thus helped the provocateurs. Another contributing factor was the fact that no one expected any trouble. At that time, Germany was one of the most peaceful countries in the world. There was no reason to expect any kind of unrest. It was only during dinner at the old town hall that the first sporadic reports of riot and destruction reached Munich from some of the Gauleiter's home offices. At the same time, it was learned that Ernst von Rath had died in Paris from his wounds. After the dinner was over, the Führer left at about 9 p.m. and returned to his apartment. Dr. Goebbels then stood up and spoke briefly about the latest news. He informed the audience that von Rath had died and that, as a result, anti-Jewish demonstrations had spontaneously broken out in 2 or 3 places.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.